Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, Chapter 33, Activities of Kapila, Text 20.
Hitva tha ipsya satamam, abhyakandala yoshitam, kinchitstakara varanam, Pucha Vishleshanatura Tata Ipsa Tatamam Yakandala Yoshita Kinchitchakara Varanam Pucha Vishleshanatura Tata Ipsa Tatamam Apyakandhala Yoshitam Kinshishchakara Varanam Bhutra Vishleshanatura.
Translation. Although her position was unique from all points of view, saintly Devahuti, in spite of all her possessions, which were envied even by the ladies of the heavenly planets, gave up all such comforts. She was only sorry that her great son was separated from her. Purport. Devahuti was not at all sorry at giving up her material comforts, but she was very much aggrieved at the separation of her son. It may be questioned here that if Devahuti was not at all sorry to give up the material comforts of life, then why was she sorry about losing her son? Why was she so attached to her son? The answer is explained in the next verse. He was not an ordinary son. Her son was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can give up material attachment, therefore, only when one has attachment for the Supreme Person. This is explained in Bhagavad Gita, Param Drishta Nivartate. Only when one actually has some taste for spiritual existence can he be reluctant to follow the materialistic way of life. Om Gana Timanandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namah Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasudevi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. This chapter begins with Devahuti expressing her gratitude for her son, Lord Kapila Dev's, giving her transcendental knowledge. She shows her gratitude by repeating the essence of what her son has taught her, along with presenting knowledge of the transcendental nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She's aware that her son is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She's aware of his mission, which is to disseminate transcendental knowledge. What is special about transcendental knowledge? People are studying so many things. There's so many schools, colleges, polytechs, universities. Anyone can go learn something. But why is Devahuti so grateful about what Kapila Dev has given her? She's grateful because he's given her transcendental knowledge. Transcendental knowledge means knowledge beyond the reach of material nature. Transcendental knowledge means knowledge that is not affected by past, present, and future. And transcendental knowledge means knowledge beyond material contamination. Such knowledge leads to devotional service of the Lord. Lord Kapila Dev has given several chapters of information, seven or eight chapters full, which form the solid background of devotional service. In other words, for your devotional life to prosper, you have to understand the nature of the material illusion. You cannot ignore that subject matter and artificially think that you are attracted to Krishna so much that you can neglect understanding how it is that the illusion works. Our process is to learn about nescience, or illusion, and reality, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, side by side. We learn about the positive and the negative together. Those things that impede the progress of bhakti are negative, and those things that increase the taste in spiritual life, those things are the positive. We need full appreciation of both things. Sometimes young devotees, sometimes even older devotees, make the mistake of thinking, oh, I have some attraction for Krishna. I will just, that's all I need. Don't be so quick to call your little budding attraction for Krishna. Don't be so quick to treat it as something so substantial. We need solid attachment for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that comes from fully assimilating what Lord Kapila Dev has to offer. When you have a solid foundation in transcendental knowledge, then your devotion is not sentimental. It's not something cheap or flickering. Everyone knows the nature of attachments in this world. One minute you're so attached to someone or something, the next minute you're not. But when you are attached, it's your everything to you. You think, oh, this is it. This is the reality. My attachment. But then just a little bit of change, and you discard that attachment. You can even become repulsed by it. You can even hate it. So, you might think that attachment for the Supreme Personality of Godhead is like that. No. Attachment for the Supreme Personality of Godhead is beyond the mental platform of sankalpa vikalpa, acceptance and rejection. As you know, the mind is always accepting things and rejecting things. This is good. No, this is not good. I like this. No, I don't like that. All day long your mind does this, as you know. You wonder, when will this chatter ever stop? It will stop gradually, according to the degree of our immersion in devotional activities. We have all these activities for devotees so that they can have a chance to think about Krishna. You can be sure that if you don't have the opportunity to think about Krishna and Krishna's service, then you must think about material existence. You have to think about something. That is why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Manmana bhava madbhakto majaji mam namaskaru. Always think of me. Become my devotee. By always thinking of Krishna, you become a devotee. If you didn't care for Krishna, then you wouldn't think about him all the time, or try to think about him all the time. So the purpose of all our activities, the temple schedule, the activities of devotional service during the day, the outreach programs, the puja, the worship of the deity. The purpose of all that is to produce a mindset that is thinking about Krishna. And when you have the mindset of thinking about Krishna, then you don't get another material body in your next life. But if you're always thinking about material existence, then that mentality attracts a material body. The subtle mentality of thinking about illusion attracts a gross body so that you can participate in illusion. In this way, the cycle of repeated birth and death goes on. people talk today about reincarnation. It's not such a far-fetched thing as it was 20, 30 years ago. But people have no idea how their own minds are powering the wheel of repeated birth and death by the mental process. So many desires are packed up in the heart, and then they become illuminated in the mind. And then you try to accomplish these desires with your gross body. In this way, you simply increase your karma, and you bring yourself to your next body, which certainly does not have to be a human body. Now, Lord Kapiladeva is dispelling the darkness of ignorance with the most brilliant knowledge, the knowledge that cuts the root of material attachment. Not everybody wants to cut the root of material attachment, however. So many people, they think, I'll be so happy if I only have the right material attachments. It's not that material attachment is bad. It's just that I need the right kind of material attachments. The kind of material attachments I need to be happy, I just don't have right now. That's why I'm miserable. But if I get the right kind of material attachments, my life will really be into something. I was just reading a statement by the second richest man in the world. And he was one of your California boys, Larry Ellison. But he was saying, I'm a very, very happy man. I can have whatever I want. Planes, boats, ships, houses. This is what it's like when you're worth $26 billion. I heartily recommend it. I'm a very, very happy man. Now, if you are foolish, you can become swayed by that. Just see, here is the testimony of such a great person. He's happy by having material possessions. I can have whatever I want. Think about it. I'm very, very happy. If he's so very, very happy, why does he need all these things? Why does he need a yacht with a basketball, full-size basketball court on it? The yacht makers who make the yachts for all the wealthiest people in the world, they say that the main part of our job is just sitting down with these wonderfully rich people and just hearing their dreams. Let them pour out their dreams, and that way the uniqueness of their yacht will take shape. Whether they want a yacht with a tennis court on it or a basketball court, whatever. Every yacht is unique. And it's a wonderful process of just sitting down and hearing from them, letting them spill out their dreams for anything, and then fashioning those dreams into reality. So the yacht makers were saying, actually, these people become so attracted, so absorbed in pouring out their dreams and having those dreams realized in terms of their private yacht, that many times as soon as the yacht is finished, they order another one and another one just to go through the whole process of putting out their dreams. So they have a yacht for the Caribbean, a yacht for the Mediterranean, a yacht for the, you know, the North Atlantic. Because they're just so hooked, so addicted on just coming up with all sorts of unique, exotic ways to spend their money. But if you're actually happy, why do you need all that? Did you know that there has been a survey of who are the happiest people in the world from the material standard, nothing spiritual? And you know what came out as a place with world's happiest people? Bangladesh. The poorest country in the world. According to the mundane psychologist's own standards, Bangladesh, the most poverty-stricken place in the world, is where everyone's most happy. They have nothing. Nothing. Except just simplicity, inner contentment, even seen from the material point of view.
I mean, it's Bangladesh, a poorest place. Isn't that where they always have floods and thousands of people die so easily? How can that be the happiest place?
So it shows you that happiness is not what you think. So if Mr. Ellison, with his 26 billion U.S., is so happy, why does he have to constantly buy things? I think I'll have a house, a huge house that is designed as a Spanish castle. Ah, oh, yes, let it be. That's what he does. And he calls that happiness. Let me have another yacht. This one will have a small midget submarine attached to the bottom. Yes, we're doing deep sea exploration. Yes, let it be. If this is actual happiness, why is he satisfied? Why constantly more and more and more? And how quickly that so-called happiness can be finished. He doesn't dare think that even if it is happiness, and of course we will challenge that, but even if you agree, okay, let's call it happiness, how long does it last? He doesn't think like that. And the problem is, at the time of death, because of such a great attachment, he has to take birth in those circumstances of his wealth again, but not as a human being. He can take birth as a tree in his garden of his Spanish castle. He can take birth as a roach on one of his yachts. Yes, that is the way the laws of nature work. You're so attached. Okay. You can be with your attachments, but not as a human being. Laws of nature are very fair, very just. And of course, we don't accept his version of happiness as real happiness. After all, how much can you really do with your senses? There's a limit from the material point of view that you can engage your senses in. How much food, how much drink, how much sense gratification can you have before you're overloaded? That is what they don't tell anyone. He just says, I'm very, very happy. I heartily recommend it. But his stomach holds the same amount of food as you. Whether he's worth 26 billion or 1,000 New Zealand dollars, still, his stomach holds the same amount of food. And with all his 26 billion, can he get food that is spiritually satisfying as what you serve at Govinda's? This is the irony of material existence. No, 26 billion can't buy it. So therefore, wealthy people, they spend so much time and money being connoisseurs of food, wine, food, because they're not satisfied by what they eat. They never think like that. I'm so wealthy. Tonight I'll eat Italian. Tomorrow I shall eat another style. And they all have their private chefs, huge private kitchens. And all they have to do is spend a few dollars at Govinda's and they would finally taste something satisfying. No, I have 26 billion. I would never walk into that place. Strange people. Instead, he'll waste his money trying this kind of food, that kind of food, this kind of wine, that kind of wine, in a vain search for satisfaction. Nor does he see the illusion that comes with that so-called happiness. It's blinding him. Gives you pride. I hardly recommend it. I can have whatever I want. This is what it comes. This is what it's like when you're worth U.S. 26 billion. Material nature easily finishes it all in a second. But the intoxication from that kind of material possession is so great that you become mad. This is why Queen Kunti prays in the first canto of Bhagavatam, Janmaishvarya Shruta Shivya Eda Mana Madhap Puman. Those who have the opulences of birth in an aristocratic family, riches, bodily beauty, and education, they become mad, they become intoxicated. It's very difficult for them to approach the Supreme Lord. We have to look at the advantages and disadvantages of all situations in life. And Lord Kapila Dev is teaching you, he's equipping you with the tools by which to become free. Where is the education that teaches you how to become free from material existence? Where is the education that teaches you what is the source of material existence and what is the spiritual reality and how to live in that spiritual reality? Where is that kind of education? Well, I was recently in South Africa, and I always like to tell the devotees there how where I went to university, the tuition now is for 4 years is $100,000. $100,000. Yale University is $25,000 a year. So after 4 years of that, I was still looking for real knowledge. And I spent $2 on a Krishna conscious book. And then I realized my education is now complete. $100,000 worth of education could not surpass a Bhagavad Gita for a few dollars then. So you see, people don't know what is valuable. They don't know what is happiness. They simply accept what's shoved at them. This is happiness, take it. Oh, okay. That's it. No ability to critically reflect on their situation. Even the material philosophers who used to be able to do that, they're finished now. At so many universities, philosophy departments are just closing down. We have our Antar Darshan. Yes, you've studied philosophy. The few people who graduate with the degrees in philosophy museum, they end up doing things like painting houses. Or who cares for philosophy? People want things that produce conveniences, things that produce luxuries and comforts, things that make money. Just like the Ministry of Education for New Zealand, I explained to you before, it makes its mission statement very clear right on the letterhead. It says, the purpose of education is to increase economic prosperity. No mission statement about the purpose of education is to help people see what is illusion and what is real. Well, forget that. We care whether it's illusion, whether it's real. Who cares? Just try to enjoy your senses. No ability to critically reflect, even like the material philosophers of yore, even that's gone. Simply feel all this pressure on you to fulfill yourself by immediate sense gratification. That's all society has to offer to you. This is the great tragedy. Now, Srimad Bhagavatam is giving us a chance to develop a completely different kind of culture. That's actually what we're trying to do here. That was Srila Prabhupada's desire, that the Srimad Bhagavatam would fashion a completely different culture for the world. So therefore, your little activities, you might see them as very little, they're important for not only you, but they're important for the whole world. Unless people can see a different way of living, they'll never stop doing what they're doing. They'll not give up their hellish pursuits unless they can see something else. By hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, you become gradually equipped with a different vision. You become transformed inside, and you start to taste a different reality. You start to taste real pleasure, and then gradually you notice your material attachments sliding away. This is the potency of Srimad Bhagavatam. Because Srimad Bhagavatam is non-different from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, When you hear Srimad Bhagavatam, you are associating with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, many people will say, well, if there's God, sure, I'd love to associate with God. But the Bhagavatam is giving you that chance. And then you say, but how can it be that just by hearing this book, I can be associated with God? Krishna can come however he likes. You cannot limit the way the unlimited appears. The factual proof that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the literary presence of the Supreme Lord is that you feel increased detachment from material nature by reading it, and you also feel increased attachment for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that is the real wealth of life, attachment for Krishna. Rati and Mati. You want attraction for Krishna and affection for Krishna. Then you're the wealthiest person in the world. So we heartily recommend Rati and Mati. So there are always two classes of people in this world, as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. Dvabhuta sarva lokesmin daiva asurevaja. Since time immemorial, meaning since the beginning of creation, there's those who are demoniacally inclined and those who are divinely inclined. Those who are demoniacally inclined, what does it mean? They have horns coming out of their head, they carry a pitchfork. No, to be demoniacally inclined means you are attached to the bodily conception of life and you think that the so-called pleasures of this world, that's it. So under the influence of the demoniac conception of life, you'll say, oh, I'm worth 26 U.S. billion. I'm a very, very happy man. I hardly recommend this to everyone. I can have whatever I want. So when this man made that statement, it was printed everywhere. Like the Acharya has spoken. I saw it. So many magazines, they had this statement. World's second wealthiest man gives his realizations. He gives the Siddhanta. And this affects people. They think, this is greatness, so we should want that also. The great man has spoken. Krishna acknowledges, yes, that's the way it is. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, yajadar charati shreshta tadeva tarochana. Whatever the great person does, the common people will follow. Whatever standard the great person sets, all the world will pursue that standard. So people don't know actually what is greatness. They don't know what is real wealth. They don't understand how simply by sitting on the floor hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, you develop the greatest assets. Now, we spoke about gratitude in the beginning. Gratitude is very necessary in spiritual life. We should be grateful to anyone who helps us in our spiritual development. Not simply one spiritual master. Of course, someone has to be the bottom line in your spiritual life. And, relationship with gurus should be such that that is the greatest impact on your life. But there are also others who have done so much for devotees, and that there should always be expression of gratitude. Devotees who don't see their spiritual master very often, they have to learn that by reality. We need guidance. And so if you're getting good guidance, you should always express gratitude. Even if you are seeing your spiritual master often, still, there's no doubt that the challenges that the illusory energy throws in your face require constant guidance. A devotee is always grateful for guidance. Whenever I meet devotees who were older devotees back in 73, when I was just a new devotee, I always thank them for whatever help they gave me, even though that was 32 years ago. They may supposedly be householders deep in family life, and supposedly I'm a sannyasi, but still, I thank them for whatever efforts they made. And by thanking someone, that encourages the person to reach out to others. It's very good for yourself to express gratitude, and it's very good for the other person too, because then that person thinks, oh, I didn't realize that what I did was had such an impact on you. Let me go and help others. By expressing gratitude, that brings to the forefront of everyone's vision the need to reach out and care for others rather than be selfish in your Krishna consciousness. So you should always express gratitude. That's healthy emotional development in Krishna consciousness. Anyone who's done anything to help you in Krishna consciousness, thank them. Don't let them forget it. That's the kind of culture we want to create. Even better than a culture of respect is a culture of gratitude. And gratitude is actually an easy thing for to emotionally express. If someone has helped you, if someone has made your Krishna consciousness easier, thank that person. Sometimes even persons who have helped you in your Krishna consciousness, later they may have some difficulty, hopefully just temporary. Still there's no harm in your thanking that person for what they did for you. Your thanks might even encourage that person to come to the higher platform again. So we want to develop this culture of gratitude. That is healthy emotional expression. Devahuti is doing that with Lord Kapila Dev. She's expressing her gratefulness for all the instructions he's given her, how to separate spirit from matter and get to the root of both. That is real Sankhya Yoga. Intelligence is meant for that kind of yoga, to analyze what is real, what is not real, and find the root. And then use your senses to give pleasure to the root of all existence. Use your senses for Krishna's service. That is real yoga. So Devahuti understands that. She's not like Mother Yashoda in Vrindavan. Devahuti understands, my son is the supreme personality of Godhead. Yashoda in Vrindavan, she never cared to understand her son as God. Even if she would start to think, who is my son? Krishna's yoga maya potency in Vrindavan would cover her and prevent her from thinking too deeply about who is Krishna. Just like when Krishna's friends accused him of eating dirt. Krishna said, no, mother, they're just lying. They're angry at me because I'm not playing with them anymore. Therefore, they made up this story. So Mother Yashoda said, all right, very well. We'll see who's telling the truth. Simply open your mouth and I'll see. If there's no dirt there, you're innocent. If there's dirt there, you're guilty. And you know what happened when little Krishna opened his mouth? Mother Yashoda looked in and saw the entire cosmic manifestation, including herself. And seeing this extraordinary sight, she began to philosophically speculate, what's going on? What's happening? She began to reflect. Am I sick? No, that can't be. I'm in very good health. Am I dreaming? No, that can't be. I'm wide awake. Maybe it's the demigods bewildering me. No, that can't be. I'm just an ordinary housewife. Why would the demigods want to bewilder me? Then she just concluded, somehow or other my son has these strange abilities. Anyway, he's still my son. Let me feed him. So Mother Yashoda did not care to know who is Krishna. She did not care to know about his Aishvarya, his opulence. And nor did Krishna want her to know that. Vasudeva and Devaki, sometimes they knew Krishna was God and sometimes Krishna's yogamaya covered them over. They're in between. They're nearing the Vrindavan platform. But Yashoda, Nanda, they're Vrindavan devotees. Rather than know, they love. The culmination of knowledge is love. So much talk about love in this world. People haven't given up trying to love. But they haven't developed the humility to understand they don't know what love is. Everyone yearns for love. They don't understand the proper culmination of real knowledge is love. Real love. How many enroll at a university with the goal of all this knowledge I'm going to study is going to teach me what real love is? No. All this knowledge I'm studying is going to lead me to a very nice, comfortable economic position. Hasn't dawned on anyone that if you truly want to love, you need knowledge. The goal of all knowledge is pure love. That is the goal of real knowledge. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Vedaishta Sarvai Ahameva Veda. By all the Vedas I am to be known. I'm the goal of Vedic study. So when you say Vedic culture, you mean Krishna culture. The goal of what Lord Kapila Dev has taught his mother is pure love. So she's appreciating, she's expressing her gratitude. And then Lord Kapila Dev replies, certifying, yes, mother, what I have taught you will easily give you the supreme perfection of life. What I have taught you will make your life all successful. So he reaffirms, he reconfirms. That is the job of the spiritual master, to point out to the disciple, yes, you're doing nicely. Yes, go on like this, you will get the goal. Reaffirmation, reconfirmation is very important in our lives. So we see in this interplay between Devahuti and Kapiladeva all the healthy emotional behavior in Krishna consciousness. There's gratitude, there's reciprocation, there's reaffirmation, there's reassurance. Yes, mother, you're doing the right thing. Keep on like this. It's easy. The goal will be achieved. That's what Lord Kapiladeva told his mother. And then he left home. As you've been hearing, the Vedic system is that when the husband leaves home, the woman is under the care of her oldest son. And now the oldest son has left home. So Devahuti is going to stay by herself, surrounded by her maidservants, and she's going to practice her spiritual processes at home. It seems like she's overwhelmed by material lamentation about her son being gone. As stated in today's verse, although her position was unique from all points of view, saintly Devahuti, in spite of all her possessions, which were envied even by the ladies of the heavenly planets, gave up all such comforts. She was only sorry that her great son was separated from her. So how is it she could give up all material comforts? Yet, she seems to have an attachment about her son. But her son was not ordinary. And the separation that she felt was a spiritual emotion. It caused her to think about her son more. And in her case, thinking about her son meant self-realization, because her son was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's a special planet in Vaikuntha, in the spiritual world, where Devahuti and Kapiladeva reside. So, she had a right to be attached to her son. The whole process of bhakti is meant to lead us to attachment for Krishna. Only when there's attachment for Krishna can we give up material existence. Otherwise, the greatest metaphysical scholars, the greatest mystic yogis, have been trying to get out of material existence for countless births. They can't do it. Unless you have this spiritual taste of relationship with Krishna, you cannot get out of material existence. That is the basic fact. Sometimes new people approaching Krishna consciousness wonder, it looks good. Yeah. Most devotees look pretty good too. I mean, I've seen a few spacers, but yeah, see one or two wild guys, but for the most part, they look kind of special, kind of bit of a glow. Many of you can remember when you first came to Krishna consciousness, you saw all devotees were like shining. Then after you were around for a while, you know, and made a few offenses, then you started, you know, this one, that one, I remember in the beginning, when you just thought, I remember when I was a new devotee, I just thought every devotee was like, you know, the greatest. Now, it's true, you have to develop discrimination. You have to be able to discriminate between different levels of devotees. And it is true. You're going to see some devotees are not strict, some are strict. Just like in any hospital, some patients follow the doctor's instructions, some don't. That's to be expected. As Srila Prabhupada explained, we're not utopians. Welcome to the temple. Here everyone follows strictly. Everyone's always going to follow strictly. La-di-da. No. Welcome to the hospital. We've got good patients, we've got bad patients, and in between. And sometimes they're good for a few years, then go bad. Sometimes they're bad for a few years, then become good. It's up, down, all around. And then we got some steady ones, too. That's the reality. You go to any school, polytech, college, university, there's good students, there's medium students, and there's the slackers. Maybe some of you, in your secondary school days, you were slackers, you know, when the teacher's in the front of the room teaching, you're in the back talking and, you know, making mischief and, you know, sending notes and... They do that in schools here in New Zealand. All the slackers are in the back of the room, you know, having, what do you call it, that was the thing, spitball fights. the kids would crumple up, you know, a little piece of paper, put it in their mouth, and then throw it at somebody. They don't do that here? Yeah, spitball fights. That's a great way to stay at the back of the classroom. And then in the front of the classroom, there are the teacher's pets, right? You know, the teacher's in front, teaching biology or mathematics, and the teacher's pets are just right in front, just lapping it all up. And then the slackers are in the back of the classroom, just ignoring all the lessons and just, you know, checking out the girls and, you know. So, similarly in Krishna consciousness, it's like that. We have the full spectrum of devotees who start off serious and some remain serious. Then we have devotees who start off serious and they slack off. Then we have devotees who start off not serious and they become serious. It's the real world. That is what Prabhupada meant when he said we're not utopians. We're dealing with reality. Some people follow the doctor's instructions all the time. Some people follow the doctor's instructions some of the time. And some people never follow the doctor's instructions. Maybe you've had an experience. You were very sick, and you went to a doctor, and he prescribed you medicine, and you started taking it, and then you stopped. You just didn't feel like it. Happened to anyone here? Yeah, you just didn't feel like it. I'm all right. I took it enough already. So, similarly, it's like that in terms of some person's reactions to Krishna conscious instruction. Okay, I did it enough already. I chanted. I got up early for 2 years. It's enough. So that's the reality. We're not utopians to expect otherwise. Nevertheless, the fact is that just as Lord Kapila Dev told Devahuti, completely reassuring her, this process is easy, it works. Similarly, the fact is the Krishna conscious process that we have here works. Don't ever become too familiar with the process. Oh, the deities will be here no matter what, whether I come or not. And I've already been through that initial enthusiastic phase. Now I've got to push on my life in other ways. I still believe in God. I know we're not the body, but still you have these bodies. And on it goes. Now, don't become familiar with the process of devotional service. Every day should be a wonder if you're properly situated in Krishna consciousness. Every day is amazing. I can chant Hare Krishna. I can hear Srimad Bhagavatam. I can worship the Supreme Lord. I can associate with devotees. Every day should be a sense of wonder. How do you get that sense of wonder? You've got to ask for it. This is how you develop emotions in bhakti yoga. You ask Krishna for these emotions. I can give my example from myself. At the end of this past trip, 5 months. It gets very grueling. You try it sometime. Master Carlos found out. First, like traveling, wow, yes, I'm going to travel with the Maharaj, wow. But after airport, country after country, you just start to get weary. So I found myself the last few weeks before it was time to return, I was starting to think, oh, I just can't wait to get back. Oh, I just can't wait to get back to Christ Church. Oh. You may like that, but but meanwhile, I have some service to do where I'm at. So it's not the best attitude to maintain. So I prayed to Krishna. While I'm here, I have to be fully absorbed in being where I am at the present moment for Krishna's pleasure. Krishna has me here for a reason in this place I'm at now. How can I serve Krishna best right now? So I began to pray to the Lord, please reveal to me please reveal to me service possibilities in this present situation. Not that I just, start pining, when will this trip be over? Now you gotta understand how I would think like that. After 5 months of traveling, 5 months, another day, another airplane, your body really takes a pounding. You're actually voluntarily accepting inconvenience. There's nothing glamorous about airline travel, in case you don't know. Your health takes such a beating because there's different types of water and air and food everywhere, and your body's not accustomed to some places. You get parasites, this, that, the other. It's quite austere. So naturally, after 4.5 months of that, you start thinking, oh, when is this going to end? When will I get back to Christ Church and get waited on hand and foot? But even though there's more than enough justification for me to think like that, because your body's taken such a pounding, still, I thought, this is not the best attitude I can offer to Krishna. The best attitude I can offer to Krishna is, okay, in these last 2 weeks here in South Africa, how can I best serve you? Please reveal to me the best way I can do service now. Then when it's time to go, I'll go. But right now I'm here at this place. So, these are the emotions involved with devotional service. Devotional life is rich in emotions. We just have to know how to recognize spiritual emotions and develop them. Otherwise, unless we know about spiritual emotions, we'll make the mistake of thinking that for my inner fulfillment, I have to engage with material emotions and material relationships. Because we took for granted the bhakti experience. But Devahuti is not like that. She's shown her gratitude, even to her own son. She expressed her gratitude and Kapila Dev reciprocated by reassuring her. It's not on the cover of this book, but this book doesn't have the cover on it, but there's that famous picture of Lord Kapila Dev on a Anavyasa-san, his mother, seated below, and Lord Kapiladeva instructing his mother. There's a time in my own mother's life when she started reading Bhagavatam. And so somehow or other she saw that picture. So one time I came to visit her, and she sat me down on the couch, and then she sat on the floor and said, "Okay, is this how it's supposed to be?" Of course, now I explained to her that that she's supposed to be, she's supposed to be listening to her oldest son, but she doesn't like that. She doesn't like me to treat her like a little girl. And she had me when she's 21, so even from the material point of view, that's not that much older. But she doesn't like it. Just always treat your mother with respect. Don't try to instruct me. So she saw that picture of Kapiladeva sitting on a Vyasasana, expounding transcendental knowledge with Devahuti seated on the floor at his feet. And just seeing the picture inspired her to have the right attitude. Srila Prabhupada said that the pictures in these books are windows to the spiritual world. So I could see that. Just that picture had the effect upon her. By looking at the picture, she, with her female intuition, she picked up on all the proper emotions that were good for Krishna consciousness. We should also be very quick to sense what are healthy emotions in devotional service. Just like I was concerned right before I return. I'm feeling all this weariness. I have a right to feel weary after traveling on 5 continents. But still, is this the best emotion I can offer to Krishna? I don't think so. The best emotion I can offer to Krishna is to still feel the wonder of the service situation. Krishna, what wonders can you show me in this situation? How can I act for your pleasure in this situation? That's a better emotion than even though one is entitled to feel exhausted. All right, any questions? Yes? Respect is something. Respect older devotees, respect all living entities. Still, we're not impersonalists. You have to know how to differentiate. Even in Krishna Leela, there's proper dealings based on age. Krishna's always following that etiquette. The respect should always be there. At the same time, better than respect is gratitude. It's a much more impelling emotion. Haven't you ever expressed your gratitude? It's a real, like, it gets things going. Krishna likes it when devotees are grateful. Not only grateful for what their spiritual master has done, grateful for what Krishna has done, but also grateful for the other devotees. Because there's a tendency that we start taking the other devotees for granted. Look, I've been in this place with you for 10 years, 20 years. I know all your trips. I know all your faults. That tendency is there. We often take devotees for granted. Material familiarity. Because the fact is, most people don't have the opportunity. Most non-devotees do not have the opportunity to have such lifelong relationships that devotees have. I mean, just think about it. I can go anywhere in the world and find somebody I've known for over 30 years. That is quite unusual. Anywhere in the world I can go and find somebody I knew for more than 30 years. quite extraordinary. So the downside of that is you can start taking devotees for granted. We should always pray to Krishna, let me be grateful. If you're grateful, you won't take devotees for granted. If you think about how various devotees have helped you in your spiritual life and always express your thanks, that causes the culture of gratitude to increase, because the devotees who've reached out, they'll feel inspired to reach out to others based on that gratitude that you've shown for them. So yes, gratitude is more impelling than respect. Respect has to be there, but beyond respect is gratitude. Now you can see that even in your home life. Whenever you've expressed your gratitude for your wife's cooking, hasn't it made a big difference in the... Okay, this is what it's all about. So, Krishna's also a person. On the other hand, if you spend your whole day finding someone's faults, how quickly your life becomes miserable. So, creating a culture of gratitude and thankfulness for the devotees, appreciation for the devotees' sacrifices, that presents a very attractive atmosphere. That's real culture, real spiritual culture. The Devahuti is showing that, even to Kapiladeva, who's her son. And Kapiladeva is reciprocating. Naturally, Devahuti is sorry her son has gone, but that is spiritual separation. She's not attached to anything material. Anything else? Yes. First of all, every devotee has appreciation for all devotees. But secondly, in family life, if Krishna is in the center, why should you not be appreciative of the other person? Everyone has their human side. It's just that the most important aspect of life is attachment for Krishna. Often our problem outside of India, outside of Indian culture, the problem the rest of the people in the world have is they're not attached enough to their family life. You know, they drop it so quickly, change partners so quickly, don't take care of their kids. That's actually the problem. In India, generally the problem is too much attachment. They'll take everything in the Vedas to prove eternal family attachment in a temporary world. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you should be attached to your duty. Well, what about the other part of the verse where Krishna says, but you're not entitled to enjoy the fruits? I'll never quote that one. Krishna says, be attached to your duty. But in the Western world, you're seeing a practical disappearance of family life. If you've read the latest On the Way to Krishna I've written, you'll see that the scientists are now coming up with a way that you can have three parents. Three parents can contribute to your conception. You can get genetic material from three parents. They take the egg from one mother, fertilize it outside the womb, and then take part of an egg from another mother and fuse it all together. So actually you have three parents. They haven't achieved a live birth in this way. They have achieved a pregnancy, but not a live birth. So now they're trying for a live birth. So, outside of Indian culture, the main problem is not enough attachment. Or simply attachment to passion, that's it. And a passion-based relationship cannot last. These days, as you know, people don't even bother to get married. What's the point? There was a survey done in the UK recently of so-called single mothers who had children. But they all had partners. And so each of the mothers was saying, marriage, there's no need to marry. I mean, my partner and I, we're going to be together through thick and thin. What is the need of marriage? They completely don't even know the statistics that there's practically 1 or 2% chance that their relationship with their partner is going to survive more than a few years in the future, even though she has a child. But they all said the same thing. Why do we need marriage? My partner and I have a deeper understanding than that. We're going to be together through it all. Yeah, they all said that. As if, that's the way the world is. When the statistics say completely the opposite, there's a 98% chance that this relationship is not going to survive more than a few years. This is what's going on. So, in Krishna consciousness, we're happy to have wholesome families, functioning families, not dysfunctional families, where husband and wife care for each other with Krishna in the center. And they raise their children in Krishna consciousness. We're very happy for that. Okay. Having said all that, I've noticed that particularly in places like New Zealand, unless the ladies have a chance to do something in this world before they settle into family life, they're not very peaceful in their family life. They have to have a chance to kind of assert themselves in the world and do their thing. It's just the way the Kiwi material nature is. And then once they either tried and failed or tried and succeeded, then they kind of settle into family life. But before that, no. And if they prematurely get into family life before they had a chance to fly their flag, they're not very peaceful at home. They give their husband a tough time. Why do I have to stay home all the time and take care of the kids? Why don't you stay home? There's a few places in the world like that. New Zealand, Scandinavia, where the ladies are very assertive. Anyway, whatever. That's the way it is. We've got to work with that. Krishna consciousness can be applied in any situation. Just you have to know the art of the particular time and place, how to deal with that. So I've noticed here the ladies, they have to do their thing. They've got to try to do something, achieve something. And then later, when they feel ready, they settle into family life peacefully. Otherwise, no. They've always got this feeling, I could have achieved so much, but my family got in the way. Statistics for New Zealand show that 20 years ago, maybe not even that far back, maybe just 10, 15 years ago, the average New Zealand woman gave birth to her first child when she was 24 or 25. Now the age is 32. Because all the ladies are thinking, first career, and then when I feel satiated in my career ambitions, then I'll settle into family life. That's just the way it is. So to a certain extent, what goes on inside Krishna consciousness is affected by what goes on outside. You can't deny that. It's not that people just walk in the door here, grab some Jaffa Bees, and become Paramahansas overnight, transcendental to all material influences. Maybe some of you here. No. The conceptions that are predominating in the atmosphere outside are going to influence you for some time until, if you seriously chant Hare Krishna, you're able to rise above all these external influences. So I've noticed, for the most part. Maybe not so much in Christchurch, just in the North Island. They've got to have their high-powered career development, you know, for some time. And then they say, okay, all right. Time for a family. Okay. That's just the way it is. So, Krishna consciousness is not some kind of blind fanaticism that we just apply very rigidly. If that was the case, we'd have all the girls married when they were 12. That's actually first-class civilization. But as we all know, that's not a good thing. Better you spend your teenage years sampling everyone, right? That's civilization. Even my mother, she was married at 18 or 19, and when I was a little boy, she told me, she was a strict Christian, she told me, "Son, always remember this. Don't make the mistake I did. Don't marry at 18 or 19. You know, shop around a bit." Of course, her idea of shopping around wasn't, you know, anything wild. It was, you know, go to church, you know, and see different girls there in at church at the Sunday program. Go to the church dinners and sit next to different ones and see what they like. But anyway, strict Vedic culture means ladies are married at 12 and men are married no later than 25. As Prabhupada points out, even in India, the first half of the 20th century, it was not unusual for a girl to give birth in marriage to a child at the age of 12. It was not unusual. There's a lot of good points for that, because at that age, the girl's got so much energy. She's, you know, taking care of kids. As you can tell, it takes a lot of energy. You know. As ladies who have children in, very late in life, they can tell you, it really takes the wind out of your sails. But when you're a young teenager, better you put all that energy into taking care of your kid than, going wild. But we can't just apply that rigidly, that standard, to society today. First of all, people think it's horrible. This is a cult. This is abominable. Getting girls married at 12. But let the girls run wild and service everyone? Well, that's enlightenment. So we have to be practical about the circumstances we live in. And also, we've seen that in cases when this Vedic culture, which is the best culture, was applied, sometimes because the modern participants aren't fully understanding it all, they become resentful later. I tried to be Krishna conscious. I let myself get married when I was 14. Oh, I never got a chance to develop my career. So we don't want to deal with all that. We look at the way society is happening and we try to guide it. We try to deal with the realities in a Krishna conscious way. So for myself, I particularly noticed in New Zealand that Kiwi ladies got to do their thing. So you just let them go for it. Then at the right time, and these days the right time means 32, 33, then so many of them say the same thing. Yeah, of course, marriage, family, but not now. I got a few things I want to do right now. So, Krishna consciousness is the art of the possible. Yes, Vedic culture is the best thing, but it's not possible to apply Vedic culture completely. Sometimes when Srila Prabhupada would be discussing the glories of Vedic culture, how society was arranged, he would see devotees kind of just becoming very discouraged. They were just kind of sinking. You know, like, and Prabhupada would say, no, don't be despondent. Just chant Hare Krishna and everything will be all right. The chanting of the holy name makes up for all the piety that's missing, all the sanity that's missing. But if you don't chant Hare Krishna with attention, what's the use then? Where are your assets going to come from? Where's your spiritual wealth going to come from? Anything else? Yes. That's not obvious to you? Your happiness in material life can only happen in certain places. Can't happen everywhere. Therefore, even the super rich guy, Larry Ellison, he's got to have a home here, a home there, a yacht here, a yacht there. And he's trying to fight off the limitations of space. I'll have a yacht on every ocean. That way my pleasure will be able to be had everywhere. He's concerned with space and its limitations. He doesn't understand it. And then time. What about if I'm on the middle of my glorious yacht? I'm on my yacht in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and I get an urge to play basketball. What am I going to do? That's it. The next yacht's going to have a full basketball court on it. I'll defeat time in that way. Anytime I want to play basketball, I'll have that court there. And what if I want something else? Suppose I want to experience Turkish cuisine. And I'm at my home in northwest USA, far from Turkey. Know just what to do. I'll just pay any kind of money to get the best Turkish cooks to come stay at my house. He's trying to defeat the limitations of time and space. So he can have whatever he wants, anytime, anywhere. That's what he considers happiness. How a devotee understands, this is hellish to be the victim of such uncontrolled desires. What the satisfaction, as we said, that you're getting by sitting down and taking prasad, that second richest man in the world will never have, unless rather he meets a devotee, takes prasad. He'll never get that satisfaction that you get just by eating one samosa with chutney on it. You notice there's something special about the food? Yes. Many years ago, sometimes in Los Angeles, devotees would sell cookies on the side of the highway. And sometimes the people would... This is back in the more closed-minded days of the USA in terms of quote-unquote new religions, NRMs, new religious movements. They since understood that actually Christianity is the new religious movement. But anyway, devotees would be selling cookies on the side of the road. Really beautiful tasting cookies. And sometimes people will come up to them and say, oh, cult cookies. There's something special about these cult cookies. That was about 25 years ago. But you know how life in California is, you know, room for everybody, everything, you know. Anyway, it's something so special about prasad that even the wealthiest people in the world, they can't get. That's why they want Turkish, this, that, other, all types of cuisine, because they're never satisfied. So that's what I mean by happiness limited by time and space. There's always some condition. Material life means the separations imposed by time and space. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.